Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another exciting episode we have today of Crime and Science Radio. Today's show is called The Anatomy of Innocence, an interview with author, legal scholar, and advocate Laura Caldwell. So without any further ado, here's your hosts of the show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome everyone. We are so pleased to have Laura Caldwell with us today. I have to say, you know, we've had some amazing people on the show, but I especially love it when we have someone who, you know, as Laura is doing, which is just to identify a problem that really affects lives and doesn't just say, oh, that's a shame, you know, something ought to be done about it. She did something about it and continues to do something about it. So you'll understand what I'm alluding to here soon. She's a former civil trial lawyer. She's now a distinguished scholar in residence at the Loyola University Chicago School of Law. And she's the director of Life After Innocence, which you'll be hearing much more about soon. She's also the published author of 14 novels and one nonfiction book so far, more to come. We're hoping to hear more about that, too. And just someone I'm very proud to know. So welcome to the show, Laura Caldwell.
Thank you. What a lovely introduction. Thank you.
Well, thanks for being with us, my good friend. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. We always have a good time. You're a classic underachiever, and I don't know how you accomplished anything. You're an attorney. You're a professor of law at Loyola. You run a nonprofit. By the way, you wrote a bunch of novels and nonfiction books. So let's start back at the beginning, though. What led you to go to law school and become an attorney in the first place?
Well, I gave a commencement speech at Defiance College this last Sunday in Ohio, and one of my messages was that it's okay not to have a big grand passion or a big dream. Like, not everybody has a great dream right now. Not everybody has a big passion. Some people do. You're lucky if you can identify it. But if you don't, it's okay. I was one of the people who didn't really have a grand passion. My passion in law school or college was to graduate. Like, that was my thought. Like, that was my big dream, was I would like to graduate. And when I got out and I started to formulate maybe what else could I do, it stumbled on to me that there was no one helping people who were innocent, who had gotten out of prison. And I started looking into that, and that's how I got into my law job, which is running a law clinic at Loyola Law School, where my law students represent individuals who've been wrongfully convicted. They are innocent. They were wrongfully convicted. They've been exonerated. And now they're out, and we're helping them to start over. And what we're learning about the innocence journey is that it's really hard to get out. I mean, if you're innocent, and it's really hard to get yourself out. But the whole second journey is, it's very hard to start over. So we're trying to help people with the second part. Like, if you are profound enough and lucky enough to be exonerated, then we'll help you out in Illinois. And we started it just because, essentially, there was no one else doing it.
So to go back kind of to the beginning of all this for you, though, you didn't start out in criminal law, did you? You started out, as I understood it anyway, in civil?
I did. I went to law school and got a really good job at a great firm, and they had placed me in the medical malpractice department. So I represented doctors for about 8 years. And it was a great practice. I represented doctors who were sued, neurosurgeons and orthopedic surgeons, and left my big firm to go into a small firm to just do that, to just represent small doctors, not small doctors, but doctors in general who were getting sued. And I was writing on the side. So this was a hobby of mine that I only found after I started working as a lawyer. Like I wasn't writing when I was in high school. I went to the University of Iowa. It's one of the best writing schools in the nation, and I never took advantage of the writing program. And it was only after I was out that I was starting to like write novels and try to do things that I thought maybe I could do this. So it was very a come lately kind of thing.
Well, what about teaching? I mean, did you always want to teach, or did that come along
as your career developed? It's
so
funny, Doug, because you and I have, along the years, we've run into each other at conferences, and I started teaching legal writing to like an advanced legal writing. Like, here's how, if you want to be a trial litigator, here's what you got to write. And now it's sort of advanced to, I'm teaching in China this summer, I'm teaching an international criminal court class. So it's not a writing class, but it's completely different than what I started writing. And what I love about it is that, or what I started teaching, is that really I feel like we as individuals can grow either what we write or what we teach. And I'm trying to show that to myself, that what I write can develop. So I've always written fiction, and now I'm spearheading this anthology. And in my teaching, I've always taught, you know, like legal writing, and now I'm sort of went into teaching a clinical wrongful conviction, and now in this Beijing class I'm teaching about international criminal law. So I guess I'm trying to increase my own, you know, knowledge and increase my own teaching capacity.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've always said you don't know something until you can teach it. You know, you might think
so
you
true.
Do, but until you can sit down and teach it to someone else, you don't really understand it yet.
So true.
Yeah, you can't put it into words. You can't put it into thoughts unless you know it cold.
Right.
Well, so you started doing that. You started all that. But at some point in time in your career, you ended up getting involved in real criminal cases other than the Med-Mal and stuff like that. How did that transition, and how did you like doing that?
I had a very strange experience where I was only writing fiction. I mean, I was not involved in any legal work, and I didn't feel bad about it. I wasn't doing any pro bono legal work. I wasn't doing anything. I was writing, I had sold about 7 suspense novels. So I was always working on a suspense novel, and it was great. I was like, oh, this is what I'm doing now. Every day was a Friday. And then I reached out on a research question to a woman who I'd met, and she was a criminal defense lawyer, and she told me that she had taken this case on pro bono. She said, well, I was walking around the county jail, and I started talking to this guy, and I realized that this guy had been there for 6 years without a trial. And as she's telling me this, I'm like, wait, I don't get it. She's like, no, stop, let me explain it to you again. I met someone in the county jail who's been there for 6 years without a trial. And I was just like, I don't understand that. Because I'd called her about a question about, does someone ever get convicted or does someone ever confess to something they didn't do? And she said, yeah, sure they do, like this guy. So she ended up telling me about him, and she ended up telling me a story about a guy who was 19 and had gotten pulled into a fight that he didn't do. And the more she told me, I thought, oh, my God, this guy, what's happening? And it turned out This guy had been in a holding cell for 6 years without a trial. So this was my first kind of, exposure to the criminal justice system at this level.
And that's just to follow up on that a little, I think, you know, right there are undoubtedly some of our listeners who, even though you've said this was the case, are going to say, well, people can't be held.
Right,
for
right.
6 years, and this, I'm assuming, is in a jail. He's not
mm-hmm.
been convicted of anything, right? He's
mm-hmm.
just...
correct.
Do you find it hard? I guess, you know, we can, you know, go into talking about some of this.
Mm-hmm.
The general public has, from, you know, any number of our cultural reference point, most of us don't get involved with the legal system where we end up in jail. Most of us, probably the vast majority of us haven't had an arrest. The few who may have been at a protest or something and been released, or they haven't really had to deal with
mm-hmm.
the legal system from the inside. So do you find it hard to get people to understand just
well,
even the possibility?
Yes, I do. And also, though, what I would say is if you are sitting there, as I was 5 years ago, and thinking, God, how did they get pulled into a murder they didn't commit, or how did they get pulled into this? I don't mean to scare you. I really, 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 really don't. But it can happen to anybody. And just in general, we have to be aware. We have to be aware that mistakes are made. The criminal justice system is always going to be a man-made system, which means it's always going to be open to failure. Always. When we're all, like, if we say, oh, 30 years from now, oh, my gosh, I did so much work on the criminal justice system, now it's perfect. It'll never be perfect. It's always going to be a human system. There will always be failures. So we're really not looking for, perfection. We're just looking for awareness that this kind of thing happens.
Well, what are some of the ways that the criminal justice system can break down for an innocent person?
Well, a lot of the things that there's now a fair amount of, sort of things getting taken care of is in the area of videotaped criminal confessions. So for many years, there were people confessing to murders and rapes and all these things, and then people were like, no, we didn't have any video. It was not on any, and it was just, come on. So now, in general, in Cook County, at least, you have to be arrested, you have to be processed within 48 hours, and if you have a confession, it needs to be on videotape.
And so that's, what is that catching? What is that preventing?
It's preventing some of the, where they would say it was false, kind of, you know, eyewitness testimony, where they would just sort of get someone to sign something, and it wasn't that they would confess on videotape, that they would just write something. And also that it's the way that false confessions come through is usually not through a eyewitness identification. So they're trying to weed out those kind of things.
Well, you know, we've had some people on here in the past that have talked about interrogation techniques
mm-hmm.
and talked about how false confessions occur and things like this. And obviously those shows are archived and people can go back to them. But suppose you come across and there is evidence that a person was wrongly convicted. How difficult is it, and what do you have to go through to the mechanisms to get someone reheard, retried, re-whatever, and out of prison? And what's all involved with that? What steps do you have to do?
It's nearly impossible. It's nearly impossible. It really is. Like, I mean, so the general person who is tried and convicted of a state crime goes through the mechanism, and then they come out, and then they're either on death row or they're in general population. And then what is there? All right, so you've got a state remedy, or if you've got new evidence, you can file a habeas petition. But it's very, very hard. It's very, very hard. It's very hard for it to be new evidence. I mean,
Can you explain to our listeners what a habeas petition is?
Sure. A habeas petition is, in general, a petition that says you've exhausted your state remedies. So you've been convicted at the state court. The appellate court has affirmed your sentence, as has the Supreme Court, and now you're in jail. And you've got if you've got no other remedies, like no other state remedies to seek for, then you have a habeas petition within 1 year. And they make it very hard. You gotta be really on top of your time period. But you've got 1 year from when you were deemed there was no state remedy, until you could be deemed that you could be on the other side of it. So for most people, they're waiting and waiting and waiting till their state petition is sort of, but even then, a lot of times there's just nowhere else to go, but
So if you get this habeas petition, what's the next step after that?
Great question.
Is the case then retried? Is it brought back before a judge?
If you are able to prove a habeas petition, which is newly discovered evidence, then it can get retried in front of the appellate court. So that's what you want. You want newly discovered evidence. Like that is the big thing. Newly discovered evidence. So it's kind of a drag if you've been one of those people who you dredged up all your information about all your, you know, witnesses and blah 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 blah. You really almost you hate to say it, but you almost want the person who didn't have everything dredged up, because the new evidence is what leads to your habeas petition, and that's what can lead to your overturning of your conviction.
Okay, that makes sense.
It's not fair, and I know what you're asking about, Doug, and it's not fair.
No.
But it is how it is.
So...
Well, go ahead, Jan.
I was going to say, so some of the things that are going to most commonly lead to an innocent person being convicted, I'm assuming, are things like a long interrogation. Who are innocent don't feel like they need an attorney. Or they may be too poor and don't really understand, Miranda rights being read to them or not. If they're not formally under arrest and they're free to go, but they don't realize they're free to go, so they'll may be held for a long interrogation before there's even a formal arrest.
Right.
So I think these are things that, like, the general public thinks, well, you go in there and you tell your story, and if the police believe you, out you go. but they only you're under arrest from the moment the police put you in the interrogation room. But that's, for starters, you're not under arrest quite often at that point, right?
You're right. And in general, I mean, I hate to be the bearer of, like, be careful news, but yes, if you've been picked up by the police, you need to be careful and you need to be close your mouth. And in general, that you need to say nothing until your lawyer gets there. So basically, you know, what you're kind of getting to is, like, what do you say when someone hypothetically, you know, questions you? Is that it?
Well, we've already told our listeners many times
right.
that the first thing you say is, am I free to go?
Right, am I free to go?
And if they say no, you say, why not? Am I under
That's
arrest?
Exactly.
And, so
and then
for
say,
what?
And I've got to go now. And now
yeah.
I've got to go.
Yeah.
And if they say, well, no, you're not, then your next thing you say is, I would like to...
Yeah.
Correct.
Legal representation, yes. So, yeah, don't try to do this on your own. Yeah. So,
Right.
I mean, you know, we want justice. We want the guilty people to be
mm-hmm.
caught. But we also,
right,
I think
sure.
both of us want, you know, we've seen, and I know Doug and I have both seen, I through the CRIMA project stuff and everything, even forensic science, people don't understand this, but it just like you were saying with the criminal justice system, it's a human system, so it can fail.
Right.
Of course, anything can, right?
Right.
Yes, anything can fail. I mean, certain scientific evidence, you know, we know we've got within a 90-degree certainty or whatever, but, I mean, when we're dealing with people... you know, judging people to be guilty of some crime and putting them away, we don't have a 99% degree of accuracy
that. No, not even close.
Right.
Because it depends on the story you hear and how you hear it.
That's right,
and,
Doug. That's right.
It's all subjective at the end of the day. And that makes it difficult. It makes your job difficult.
It does, but I try to not, like, point it out too much. I try not to be the person who's pointing out, you know, the infallacies or the statistical, you know, like scattered, you know, sort of, you know, things, because they're all around, and yet, I mean, this is true of anything. I mean, so
right.
we're always going to be able to shoot, you know, bad stats at. Oh, you say you're gathering all the drug cartel people and you're whatever, like, and that's not necessarily making our world, you know, cleaner. We've made a goal to arrest a certain amount of those people, and now we have. And so it's kind of the same thing with us. And so I guess we just have to keep an eye on when it's accurately, you know, arresting the amount of people we think it is for the right reasons.
The right people for the right reasons, exactly.
Right. To kind of just go back a little bit about the case that started you on this whole journey
yeah.
with is it Jovan? Is that how you pronounce
Jovan,
his name,
yeah.
Mosley? Right.
Yeah.
So Jovan Mosley's, his story essentially led you to your first
mm-hmm.
nonfiction book. What had happened to him that he ended up in jail?
Was,
is there a brief way to say it? Or?
Yeah, and I can sum it up. He was a guy who had been a good guy in a pretty crappy neighborhood. Most of the people had gone to jail. He was on his way to Ohio State. No arrests, no any involvement with the law, and then he got picked up with this fight that had happened, and he said he wasn't in the fight, which was accurate, and they eventually held him for 3 days until he said he had thrown a couple punches in the fight, and they charged him with death penalty murder, and he spent 6 years in a holding cell in Cook County without a trial, and then did get a not guilty, and he got out at 25 years old. So he'd never been arrested before and had a college graduation, you know, sort of certificate. But he has since gotten his bachelor's degree from Loyola Law School, and he's married and has two children, and he is the most delightful, wonderful person on the planet. And so he's always just showing, like, how much he can, you know, rise above the situation he was in. And he really did.
Well, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more with Laura Caldwell about life after innocence and other things she's up to these days. So hang in there.
An offering of reason. We put them all in play.
Okay, everybody. Here's what we're going to tell you about some of the new radio shows and the things that we have going on right here on Suspense Radio. We are, of course, Suspense Magazine, and we are one of the only magazines, or the only one that I know of that's in the genre that will be able to bring these great radio shows to you. And what we have are coming up, of course, we always have Crime and Science Radio that runs every other Saturday, and that is with Doug Lyle and Jan Burke, with guests that are on there from forensics to police to FBI to CIA to just a lot of different stories and things that you're going to hear about real-life police work, along with what goes on in CSI studios, labs, police thefts, courtrooms, anything and everything you can think of that has to go here with Crime and Science. Then, of course, we have our main show of Suspense Radio, which is the every other Saturday from Crime and Science Radio. This is where you're going to hear different kinds of authors, from New York Times, number one best-selling authors, all the way to debuts that are just kind of trying to get their name out there. We're going to interview them. We're going to talk to them. We're going to get inside their head. We're going to get inside their book. We're going to bring them straight to you so you have a better understanding of exactly who you're buying, what the author is, and exactly what they're doing. Now we come to our two newest shows, which is The Story Blender, which is hosted by Stephen James and Jose Castillo. This is where the art of storytelling comes into play. Every other Friday, you're going to hear The Story Blender. You're going to hear such guests as David Morrell has been on the show so far. Joe Castillo has been on the show. Robert Dugani. We have a lot more coming up with Steve Barry and some other fabulous guests. This is where storytelling is taken to the next level. How to create a story. How a story becomes one. When you're talking from the very beginning and how to tell it so when someone reads it, they understand it. You're going to learn from masters. So authors and fans and readers or whoever need to be listening to just kind of get, of course, authors, you're going to be able to understand and listen from the masters for free on exactly how stories kind of conceptualize and get themselves going. Then last but not least, we have our latest radio show here with myself, John Robb, along with Jeff Ayers, which is a multi-reviewer, along with an author. He's been doing reviews for several years, Jeff has. And this is where we kind of go in-depth and a little bit more by talking about books that we're reading, reviews on the air. You're going to hear a lot more reviews. You're going to hear a lot more in-depth detail about the publishing business, the behind-the-scenes look into it. How do you even get reviewed? I mean, how do you get Jeff to review your book here for the Associated Press, along with trying to get yourself noticed to try to get in Suspense Magazine, along with other things? Because the tips and the marketing tools and the publishing business, the query letters we go into, and everything else we have all wraps itself kind of up here into one. So you're able to have a better sense of exactly what goes on, how to get your book reviewed, how to maybe even get your book published, marketing tips, like we said, and everything else. You want to check that out. The Story Blender is every other Friday. Beyond the Cover is every other Monday. Again, that's with myself and Jeff. And then, of course, we are still partnering up with Partners in Crime Tour to bring you Suspense Radio one-on-one. So whenever there's an author that is on tour with Partners in Crime, we have them on Sundays. It's just whenever the schedule comes out to be able to bring them to you for a little one-on-one half-hour special. So you may want to make sure that you check everything out on suspensemagazine.com. We are going to have a separate radio site up shortly that are going to have all the shows. You're going to see all the links. You're going to have the books that we maybe talk about, of course, more in-depth on the authors and everything else for you. And there's only one place you can get it, and that is right here on Suspense Radio and SuspenseMagazine.com. If you have any questions, you can always email us at editor@SuspenseMagazine.com. You can put the show title in the subject line, what you're talking about. And anyone that you email, if you're talking about an author or you just want to talk to a host, we will make sure that we get it over to you. And again, as always, we want to thank you all for listening, because without you, there would be no show and there would be no magazine. So keep listening, everybody, and we will see you all on one of the days. Welcome, everybody, after the break again to Crime and Science Radio. Today's show is called The Anatomy of Innocence, Laura Caldwell. So let's get back at it with your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, we want to welcome everybody back. We're having a great discussion here with the wonderful Laura Caldwell. And we want to get into one of her passionate deals, and we want to talk about life after innocence. Tell us what that is. What is this all about?
So I stumbled sort of into, I wrote a book called Long Way Home, A Young Man Lost in the System and the Two Women Who Found Him. I wrote a book about this case that my girlfriend and I had handled where a very respectable man now, was in the criminal justice system for 6 years. He had been arrested and not had a trial for 6 years and was still in a holding cell, charged with murder. And my girlfriend found him. And I ended up helping her with the case. We were able to prove his innocence. I went to say, all right, I'd like to donate something to people who are innocent like this, who are going to start over. And it turned out there was nothing for people who are innocent who start over. So if you're like one of those guys who gets out on DNA, and it even shows who the guy was that DNA did it, it shows like the guy down the street did it, you get nothing when you start out, or you get very little. So my new sort of devotion is called Life After Innocence, and it's about helping people after they get out who have been declared innocent. And Loyola Law School, the law students work this clinic.
Well, can you give us some examples of the way it's worked and some things that you have been involved in? And
yeah, thanks for asking. So, I mean, it's really interesting. So we have a guy, for example, who Angel Gonzalez is a new client of ours. He, there was DNA when he went in. They ignored it, and finally it showed that it wasn't him. And so now when he gets out, there's nothing. So if he had been an ex-offender who had done 20 years, which he did, he came to this country when he was 19 from Cuba. And if he had, worked his number of years in the world, he would have had a certain amount of a life or whatever, but he didn't. And if he had been convicted of even a basic, armed robbery, he would have been able to do better. But he was wrongfully convicted of a murder, and it didn't have anything to do with him. And he's now been shown by Barry Scheck and DNA, and everyone agrees he's innocent. But he was a 19-year-old. Now he's 39. So our question at Life After Innocence is, what do we do with someone like that? And so what we're trying to do is help them start over. And so we realize that our contribution is small, but we're just trying to get them like up and running on what is Google, where do you want to work, where do you want to live, what's your main goals in life. And so that's our sort of main thing.
Do you help them get jobs and stuff like that?
Yeah, help them get jobs, help them understand, like, the technology. So,
right.
I mean, Doug, you and I have talked over the years about various, like, you know, like, book technology. And, like, I remember talking to you about when we were talking about when Kindle was coming in, and we were
right.
like, what is Amazon? Imagine if you have no background whatsoever in any technology, in anything, and you are getting out of an institution, and they're like, oh, here you go. Just figure it out for yourself.
Yeah.
What? Like, there's
yeah, how would you do that?
How would you do that?
We've just got a case in California of someone who was wrongfully incarcerated from the 70s. And you know, he said, you know, email, cell phone, none of this was part of his life. You know, if you gas was under a buck a gallon.
Yeah,
you know,
damn.
And the whole, it must just seem like science fiction to some of these guys.
Right, and I think that is a very frequent theme, is that it feels surreal.
Yeah.
And in fact, when I talk to psychologists and psychiatrists who work with people, that's what they often tell me, is that it seems so surreal for these people. Like, it's surreal. Like, imagine if you really didn't kill someone and someone was saying you did. I mean, that's just surreal.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how you're going to not, like, adapt to that reality. It's just a very, very bizarre thing to go through. So, and yet it's really amazing when we go to these conferences like we did this last weekend, where we went to this Innocence Conference and we had all these people from around the country getting together, including, like, Amanda Knox from Italy, who's an exoneree, and all of our exonerees and all these other people. And, oh, they get so much out of each other and so much support from each other, and it's really incredible.
Well, I was going to say the psychological impact alone of telling everyone you're innocent.
Yeah, that's
and
a good
not
point.
Being
that's
believed
a good point.
And being placed in the, well, I mean, you'd have to work hard to come up with a universe that's very different from your outside life than incarceration
right.
in a penitentiary, you know, to then have your safety at risk, your whole comfort of life threatened, and to go through that for some of these guys, you know, decades. So...
Mm-hmm.
So are psychological services part of what you offer for people, or counseling?
I'm so glad you asked that. Thank you. Actually, one of the things that we've been able to legislate and get passed is mental health services for people who can prove their innocence. So what we're trying to do is slowly add to the services that are available for people who are innocent. So a couple of years ago, we said, we got legislation passed that said, if you prove your innocence, then it you get expunged. Like, it goes off of your record, which seems basic to people, but that wasn't basic. And in Illinois, that wasn't how it was happening. So that was good. And now we're doing things like, as you said, if you can also say that you're innocent, we'll do this and that. So that's exactly what we're trying to do, is bring in services every time we can say that, you know, you've been getting an innocent sort of declaration.
So we really aren't set up for this. I mean, we're
no
set
one
up to
knows.
Prosecute.
No state is. No state is set up for this, and and it's okay. Like, it's really. I mean, I think we all have to, like, just be aware that this wasn't. Nobody was looking at this. It's not that, like, anybody was bad. It wasn't any states were terrible. This just wasn't being looked at. Now it is. Now we're trying to look at you know, what people get when they get out, what they don't get, and just trying to be real honest about it. And
it's kind of mind-boggling that this wasn't the way it was.
But you know what, that to me is so great that you would say that, because that means that you think this is a layup, that you think, yes, this should happen.
Yeah.
And that's like, for me, like, that makes me take a deep breath and be like, okay, he gets it. He knows, like, all right, great.
Yeah. We had Doug Preston on not too long ago, and he talked about his interrogation over in Italy by the same prosecutor that prosecuted Amanda Knox.
Yeah,
and he talked about how horrific it was.
Jesus,
that just 3 hours they had basically broken him, you know, and he was ready to confess. He just wanted to get out of there
easily.
And he's a smart guy. And imagine Amanda Knox, a 20-year-old, in there for however many hours she was in there, 10 or 12 hours. Yeah, so. These things do happen. I know they happen in Italy more than they do here, but they happen here.
Well, it's interesting you guys said that, because I was talking to one of our contributors for Anatomy of Innocence today, and I saw Amanda Knox this weekend, and I had asked her to be part of the anthology, and she said, if you can get, you know, Gillian Flynn to do it, I'll do it. And I emailed Gillian Flynn, and then this person I was talking to said, we need Amanda Knox either way, whether Gillian's in it or not. And I said, why do you think that? But she is like the, do you guys, you know, I mean, I know she's innocent, but
do we
know that? Yeah.
Oh yeah. The forensic evidence was non-existent.
Right?
Yeah. Forensic evidence was non-existent. Yeah.
This prosecutor has a bad track record,
yeah,
too, I think.
Yeah.
Yes, terrible.
Yep.
Yeah. So, actually, in this case, I feel so heartbroken for the Meredith's family.
Oh, I know. It's agonizing.
Within my family, we've had, you know, one of my cousins was murdered, and it's one of these situations where they have strong suspicion of the murderer, pretty much out of reach at this point. And so I know, you know, some of what it is to feel that somebody please, you know.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, when things go wrong in this way, they cause so much collateral damage, you know, like when you talk about the people in the life after innocence, the other side of this is that when you have someone innocent incarcerated, you have someone guilty, most likely on the loose, very possibly committing other crimes, you know, and you have all the victims' families who may have thought for years that the case was solved, you know, and nothing, you know. So it's the damage goes. It's horrible for the innocent people, of course, you know. But there's damage beyond that. Well, you mentioned very briefly, but let's go back to it. Tell us about the Anatomy of Innocence. This is such an exciting topic.
Yeah, this is exciting. We are putting together thriller writers, best-selling mystery authors, with exonerees to each tell a snapshot chapter of the exoneration process. So we know that no matter if you're a woman, a man, if you're black, if you're white, if you're anything, we know that if you're innocent, the first time that you get told, like, oh, you're being suspected of a crime, you're shocked. And we know that when you hear evidence coming in at a trial, it's shocking. You're like, what are you talking about? I don't know these things. And everyone thinks they're going to get a not guilty. and they don't. And then the initial times in prison are horrible for every innocent person. And there's a little adjustment period, and then there's trying to find people who believe in you, and it takes forever. And then when you kind of think you're going to get out, it really takes forever. And then finally you're out, and freedom is just the beginning. So we've identified like about 15 chapters where these are all the same things that everyone goes through, whether you are a mom who lost your kid and got accused of killing your kid, or you're a man who was accused of killing some guy on the street who you never met. These are the same, you do thread through the same chapters. So what we're doing is we've got Scott Turow and Lee Child and Sarah Paretsky and the head guy from House of Cards, John Mankiewicz. We've got them all writing a chapter with an exoneree. So it's a snapshot chapter, like bam, bam, bam. So the first one is S.J. Roseanne is writing with Gloria Killian. And Gloria was, she was a second-year law student. She, her day started out, she was walking her boyfriend's dog. And then her boyfriend came over and they were going to fool around and her lunch hour. Like, and that was like, you know, her day. Like, I'm going to fool around with my boyfriend. And knock, 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 the police came. She had no connection to this robbery and murder, but they came in and asked her about it, and that was like, you know, I mean, that was, so we start out with her, because we actually like the, you know, white lady law student, to be honest, but I mean, this was, she tells you, like, this is her, I'm just doing my normal day, and then wham. So she's our first chapter, and so we just tell this little snapshot of her writing, her walking her dog, hanging out with her boyfriend, and knock, 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 they come to the door. And then we're going to have Sarah Paretsky write with David Bates, who was a John Birch torture victim. So she's going to capture his, you know, getting the shit kicked out of him, which is tough, and they're going to do it.
So for our listeners who don't know about him, maybe tell a little bit about what you mean by being a torture victim.
Yeah, so there is an area in Chicago called Area 2 where a Chicago lieutenant named John Burge had a really good grasp of that area, and he solved a lot of crimes. And then it turned out that a lot of the crimes that he solved were confessions where maybe the people didn't really do it. And he and or his people had confessed or coerced people to confess. So he was eventually tried in the federal court, and he went to federal prison. But there's really nothing you can do if you were one of those people. So some of those people were arrested, treated unfairly, you know, dealt with unfairly, and now are out. But in general, they are, you know, fine.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, let's talk a little bit about your fiction stories and how you use your day job in your fiction.
Well, you know, I love writing fiction. I mean, fiction, I feel like, My take on writing fiction is, oh my God, why can I not get back to that? Because you can have a plane. I can have a plane go down the middle of Michigan Avenue. Like, if I want to.
Sure.
I brought this up to Lee Child when I was talking to Lee Child the other day about he's working on Anatomy of Innocence. And I said, isn't that so crazy? So what you can't do when you're dealing with a story like this, where you're dealing with, you know, someone who went through a story and they had a wrongful conviction, and you really can't take too much latitude with
right.
their story. But what if you had just like a plane go down in the middle of, you know, Michigan Avenue? And he's like, no, you can't do that. But I feel constantly like that is the gravy train. Like that's the, I don't know, I feel like that is what allows you to just turn out whenever you want and do it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think I feel like the Anatomy of Innocence
is where you're supposed to be and what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I really do. I really do. I feel like it's where it's supposed to be. And I can't tell you how much, Doug, I know you've done a number of, you know, anthologies and stuff. And I feel like every time I talk to another exoneree with another writer, it's exactly the right chapter.
Right.
Like, we've identified it. We know it. Oh, my God. I can't tell you how excited I am.
Yeah.
I feel like I am so thrilled about this. I think we've got the pairings, which are, I think we've got amazing pairings.
Good. It sounds like an amazing project.
Thanks.
And it's a great marriage.
I think, I'm very excited about participating in it, and I know you've got just some really outstanding people that we had a meeting of some of us at BoucherCon,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
there was just, I think, such excitement on the part of the writers to be a part of this. So just to, in addition to supporting Anatomy of Innocence, and I hope everyone
mm-hmm.
listening has put this on their Amazon wish list or whatever,
yeah, perfect.
Or gone to their independent bookstore and said, you know, I'm excited about this, you know, and keep watching on our site, because as soon as we can give you links to places where you can get it, we will certainly do that. But while we're waiting for Anatomy of Innocence to come out, what can members of the public do to bring about whatever needs to change for the exonerated? What can the average bear? This is something like you stepped in and did things. So what can the average bear out there do?
Yeah, I appreciate that. That's such a good question. Thank you. And I would say two things. Life After Innocence is the organization that I work for at Loyola, and it doesn't put any, you know, money in my pocket or anything else.
It's a nonprofit.
It is a nonprofit. And then I also, I've been selling the book about, you know, Jovan Mosley, which is Long Way Home. And all those profits go to the same thing, to Life After Innocence. So I would love it if that came in there. But, you know, thank you guys for, you know, really raising this issue, because I think it's important.
No question.
Well, we think it's important, too. And just so that we don't ignore this, because I know Doug had been asking about this, your most recent novel of the novels that do help you out,
personally,
The Dog Park.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you can look for that as well. And Laura's other 14 books, she's had
mm-hmm.
all kinds of recognitions. They're published in over 22 countries.
Thank you.
So it's been critically acclaimed, very successful We wish you more success.
Thank you, guys.
And get Long Way Home and watch for Anatomy of Innocence. Laura Caldwell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you, guys.
It's been a pleasure.
Bye.